vector, it contains three vector fields, which lives in the adjoint representation of the group G. So A belongs to the adjoint representation of the group G. And it's a vector field. Vector field, and we have an action for this gauge field, which is integral of dx of trace of f squared, where f is a current, is the field strength. And z is the is a covariant derivative, and we want to try to define something which is an integral of a whole gauge field configuration, exponential minus s of the action, and to do calculation out of this. And here, what we are doing is that we have a space, a big space A, which is a space of all possible A, which is a space of gauge field configuration. Well, I should write this a bit bigger. So let me write it here. I have this enormous space of gauge field configuration space. But then I have the gauge symmetry. So the gauge symmetry means that if I have an element G, so I have a gauge group, a big gauge group that I'm calling curly capital, well, calligraphic capital G, which is a group of local gauge transformation. So it's a space of functions from space on the gauge group. And you have a gauge transformation. The gauge transformation sends a gauge field configuration, which it's imaged by the action of the group G on A. So G acts on A, which is, if I'm not mistaken, this is. So you have to remember that A belongs to the adjoint representation. So AG is G times A to G minus 1. That's the usual action of a group on its adjoint representation. But of course, it's a gauge. A is a gauge field, so it doesn't transform covariantly. So you have, in addition, plus I G times D of G minus 1. And this belongs also to the adjoint representation. Okay, so it's a very compact notation for the explicit transformation law that I wrote on Monday in terms of component in space-time, etc. And we know that we have gauge invariance, namely that A of A is always equal to A of AG, the image. So which means that the group G acts on A, and you have orbits of equivalent, of physically equivalent configurations, gauge equivalent configuration. And in fact, the space of physically inequivalent configuration of the field, I call it, I think, C, is a quotient of A by the action of G. So it's a space of orbits. So in this big path integral, in fact, what we want to do is to integrate in some way under the space of orbits. And the fact that the action is constant on the slice, on the gauge, means that you cannot do perturbation theory in a naive way, because perturbation theory involves expanding around a classical solution. So even if you have somewhere a classical vacuum, which is generally A equals zero, if you make perturbation of the gauge field in this direction, the action stays zero. Therefore, you have flat direction. So you cannot invert. You can define what is the second derivative of the action with respect to variation of the field, but this Hessian operator will have an infinite number of null vectors, which correspond to the gauge transformation. So you cannot invert and calculate a propagator. And this problem is already present in the Maxwell theory. Okay. So we have to find a way to integrate in a sensible way over the space of orbits. Okay. So that's what gauge fixing does. So gauge fixing, and that's again very classical, is just choose a representative in each orbit. So in each orbit, I choose a representative here, I choose a representative here. And therefore, I define what is called a gauge slice. And with this, we think we are in a good position, because if we integrate over a gauge slice, we are sure that we integrate in the path integral, or we work in physics, with only inequivalent gauge configuration, or inequivalent physical states. Okay. So gauge fixing is choosing a slice. But of course, you have different inequivalent way, because you can choose a slice like this, but you can choose a slice like this, or a slice like this. And choosing different slice should lead to the same result. So choosing slice should give the same result if we quantize properly. Otherwise, we have broken gauge invariance explicitly, and if we have broken gauge invariance explicitly, we know that we are in trouble with unitarity, locality, and Lorentz invariance. Okay. So that's a very general feature, already present in Maxwell's theory. So, in fact, fixing a slice can be done by enforcing a gauge fixing condition. And a gauge fixing condition, in most cases, amounts to choose or find a function f of a, so a function on the space of slice, on the space of gauge configuration, such that the sets of a, which are such that f of a equals zero, equal the slice, the gauge fixing slice. Okay, it's just a formal way to state that, for instance, if we walk in some gauge, we fix that some function of the field and its derivative are zero. So I'm going to give example, but first, so f is going to be, in fact, f is such that for any x position and A equal 1, 2, 3. We enforce that you have three functions f of A, such that fa of A of x, some d mu of A of x, and potentially some other, is equal to 0. So in fact, f that I denote here as f of A is a set of such functions. So you see, so you see that there is an f of A for each A and for each x. So there is a gauge condition. This is a gauge fixing condition. So there is a gauge fixing condition for each point in space-time and for each index in the adjoint representation for each gauge field. Okay. And so, for instance, so in fact, if you think about that, f is a function from A, the space of gauge fixing condition, onto the Lie algebra of the big gauge group. Because the Lie algebra of the gauge group is a space of function from space onto the Lie algebra of the gauge group. And the FAs are coordinates. Okay. So you should think of f as really a function, but a function from A, this big space, onto the Lie algebra of the gauge configuration, which is basically the tangent space to the slice. At a given point A in A. You choose a point. This slice is, in fact, you know, it's not one dimensional, but it has infinite dimensional. But you consider the infinite the tangent slice here. And it's isomorphic to the Lie algebra of the gauge group because it's just generated by infinitesimal transformation. Okay. So F is a function, but from this big space to this slightly less big space. And that's, of course, it's a Lie algebra, so that's a vector space, while this is a complicated space. Okay. And so the gauge fixing condition is just that to fix f of A equals 0. So this is f of A equals 0, and if you have chosen another condition, f prime, f2, let's say, this is f prime equals 0, this is f double prime equals 0. So you choose different function. Okay. So it's an examples. Well, I'm going to deal, in fact, mostly with the Lorentz or Landau gauge, where you enforce that at each point, the derivative of mu A of x is equal to 0. So the function f is a set of d mu A, if you want. So it amounts to state that f of A is d mu A. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, d mu A mu. So it's a divergence of mu. Note that this is the ordinary derivative, not the covariant derivative. Okay. And there is a slightly different function, which is what's called the Feynman gauge. It's convenient for calculation, where you choose an epsilon function. You choose a function epsilon, which is a function from spacetime M onto the Lie algebra of G, of little g. So to each point, you associate a function, and you just state that d mu a mu a of x is epsilon a of x. So instead of enforcing that this is zero, you enforce that this is some fixed function, and you are free to choose a function. Sometimes it's convenient not to take. So epsilon is a fixed function. So epsilon is a gauge fixing parameter. So with this, you can always explore how things changes when you change gauge fixing condition. Okay. But of course, you have many other conditions. For instance, you have the non-relativistic gauge condition, like the Coulomb gauge or the axial gauge. But the advantage of the Lorentz gauge or of the Feynman gauge is that there are Lorentz invariants. Yes?
Is M the manifold of spacetime?
Is
M?
Yeah, M. I just denote M for Minkowski. That's spacetime.
And it maps to the Lie group of, is that little g or big?
Well, here, epsilon a is a, well, these are a component of the Lie group. Because you can write that epsilon of x is epsilon a of x ta. But remember, ta as the element. So epsilon of x is a function from spacetime to the Lie group of the gauge group.
Gauge, like the little curly g.
The little group, g. Not the calligraphic g.
Oh, right. Okay, so SU2 in this case.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you may consider that epsilon as a function is an element of the Lie algebra of the big group. So epsilon, you consider epsilon as a function belongs to the Lie algebra of the big gauge group. It's a bit, so epsilon of x belongs to the Lie algebra of the gauge group. It's a bit of a formalism, but well, I'm French, so I like formalism. But also it's convenient because it makes very compact notation for the following of the argument where you don't have to care about indices. Okay. Okay, so now we want to perform an integral, pass integral, taking into account the fact that we want to use a gauge fixing condition. Yes?
How do we know that, so that for each orbit, the condition that we enforce can be satisfied?
We do not know in general. No. Yeah, of course. No, that's a very good question. We do not know. We have to choose a function so that this is satisfied. You can take function where this is never satisfied. So of course, a good gauge fixing is that for any a, there is a g such that f of a g equals zero, and that's going to be important. That's the first condition, and second condition is better if there is only one such G. Because if you have more than one such G, this means that somehow your gauge slice is something like that. And you perform overcounting. So if you have several functions, This is called Gribov copy problem. Yes.
But so if you only want one such G, is that
yes.
G not always going to be the identity?
What? No. You mean if there?
You've defined F such that F of A is.
No. F is a function such that on each slice there is an A which satisfies it.
All right. Okay.
So for a general, A. So you start from here, and you hope that there is a group gauge transformation that sends you to the slice. Okay. So if not, it's called the Gribov copy problem because you have several inequivalent gauge field configuration, which are gauge equivalent, but which satisfy the gauge fixing condition and which are physically equivalent. Okay. And in fact, it's a serious problem. And it's still, I think, not completely understood because, for instance, the Lorentz gauge exhibits this problem. It's not a problem for Maxwell's theory, but it's a serious problem for non-abelian, for instance, for SU2 and the Lorentz gauge. Okay, so the problem exists, which means that you have to be more careful. However, in perturbation theory, that's not the case because somewhere here you have the A equals zero classical vacuum. And you can show that if there is a Gribov copy problem, it's at a finite distance in configuration space from the classical vacuum. So as long as you do perturbation theory, you are exploring this region, and this would be okay. Okay. So there is this Gribov copy problem, but forget about it from now on today. Okay. So what is the trick? Well, the trick is very simple. You want to integrate over a gauge slice, but the question now is which measure on this gauge slice is compatible with the big measure we had on the whole space of configuration, which was gauge invariant. So this measure is gauge invariant. You see? We know that gauge invariance means that S of AG equals S of A, but also that D of AG, the measure, is D of A. Otherwise, the full functional integral would not be gauge invariant. Okay? And the question is which measure in the slice defined by some function f. Okay, well, so there is a way to proceed, which is due to Fadeyev, Popov in Russia, and by Bryce DeWitt and Feynman in the US. It was done, I think, in the 60s. And it amounts to something very simple. It amounts how to write one as an integral. So let me give a very simple example. let me assume that I have an integral over the real axis. And I have a function f of x, such that f of x equals 0 implies that x equals x naught, a single point. So I have my function f here. And looking for the zeros of f, single out a single point. It's a one-dimensional, one-dimensional version of this, where I look a slice by the condition some f of some function is 0. But I'm working on a multidimensional space. Here I'm working on a one-dimensional space. Okay. And so, if I want to integrate over the real space by just picking the zeros of the function, I write that integral over dx over r, and I introduce a Dirac delta function of x minus x naught, and this is obviously 1, because there is only 1, no copies. Okay? But now, let's assume, for instance, here that the function is univalued. So it's, for instance, it has a positive slope. So I can change a variable. So f of x0 is denoted by f of x0 equals 0. So I can rewrite this as integral over dx, a Dirac delta function of f of x. But if I do that, this is not equal to 0 because I have to take into account the slope. So I have to change by taking the absolute value of the derivative of the function f at point x. Okay. Is it clear? Okay, it's just a property of the Dirac delta function. Okay. And now let's consider an integral over integral over R n. So now I have a vector x, which is x1, xn, and I have a set of function f of x, which is f1 of x1 of x up to fn of x. So I have an application. So f is an application from Rn to Rn. And let's assume that there is a single point such that the vector f of x not equals 0 as a vector. So it means that you have n vanishing conditions which are satisfied. So we have as many conditions as a noun. So generically, this single out points. So somewhere in my Rn space, I have a point x naught. Okay. Again, I can write 1 as integral dnx, well, the product of delta function of x minus x naught. And I can write this as integral dnx delta n of f of x. So this is just a product of Dirac delta function in each condition. This is equal to delta of x1 minus x1 0, etc., up to delta of xn minus delta x, well, minus x0 1, x0 n. Okay. But again, if I write that, I have to take into account the Jacobian, the slope of the multifunction. And this turns out to be just the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian of the function f of x. It's a Jacobian of the Jacobian of the change of variable. So this is f prime. So f prime of x is a matrix, which are the matrix of the whose components are the partial derivative of the A component of the vector F with respect to the variable XB. So A, B equal 1 to N. So F prime of X is a N by N matrix. And you just take the absolute value of its determinant. And again, that's valid if there is only one single X, not such that the set of condition F single out a single point. Okay? So now, the trick to perform a functional integral in a consistent way is the following. We start from the integral z, this big integral z, which is an integral over all the gauge configuration of exponential of minus s of a. Okay, and this integral has a lot of flat directions. Okay, so now let me do something. For a given A, as we have stated here, for a given A, okay, I assume that there is a unique G, and let me call it G0, which is a function of A, such that F of A, the gauge transform of A by the gauge transformation G0, is equal to 0. Okay? So this unique G0 depends on A. So in my notes, notation are getting a bit. Let's denote G0 is equal GF of A, because it depends on A and on the choice of function F, of course, because given f, for this f, if I start from A here, I have g0, and if I start from this f prime, I have a g prime. So it's a functional, it's a function of A and a function of f. Okay. And now, here, let me insert one. For each A, let me insert one. But I'm going to insert one and to write it the following way. I write it even, still for a given A, write one as the integral over the gauge group of an integral over gauge, all gauge transformation, and a Dirac delta function of G with GF of A. Okay. So this is a Dirac delta function, and this is a measure on the group, on the big gauge group. Okay. So we just need to be a bit careful because we are not working anymore on a flat space. We are working on the integral of a group. But G is a Lie group because it's a direct product of an infinite number of the SU2 group. Okay. So it has a unique up to a normalization, what's called R measure, which is invariant under the action of the group. So dG, I just take the measure on G to be the R measure. So D of G is taken to be the R measure on the group. And roughly speaking, I'm oversimplifying the mathematical theory of R measure because in general for Lie groups there is a R measure, a left R measure. It's a unique measure for well-behaved group, reducible group. It's a unique measure which is invariant under the action of the group. So you can view the group as a manifold. And if you take a point, you define a local measure on the a dG element. And if you transform it by the action on the group, so you change G into HG or GH, you end up on another point. And you want that the measure here is the image of the measure here. This means that it is invariant under the action. It is invariant under left or right action of the group on itself. Okay. And for a group like SU2, there's a unique measure which is both right and left invariant. For more complicated groups, they might differ slightly. Okay. So now I want to apply this trick to here. Because GF of A is given by the equation F of A GF of A equals 0. So I want to write this using the same trick. So I'm going to write 1 as the integral over dG of the big gauge group G of delta of G minus GF of A as integral over the gauge group with the R measure. The delta of the gauge condition F of A of G equals 0, and times the Jacobian, times the absolute value of a determinant of the derivative of the function of of J. So where this is the matrix of F with respect to variations of G, of the gauge element. A is fixed. A is fixed. Okay. So one has to be a bit careful because now F, remember, the function F belongs to the Lie algebra of the big group, so which is a tangent space to a point in the big group. The Lie algebra is a tangent space, okay? And making variation, what does it mean to make variation of this? So what is F prime? What is F prime? Okay. This means that take a G, a given element, modify it into G times 1 plus I alpha, where alpha is an infinitesimal deformation. So alpha belongs also to the Lie algebra of the group. That's the standard definition. I change G. Here somewhere I have G, and I change it by a small element, which is an element of the tangent space, so it's an element of the Lie algebra. See? Okay. So now both F, the F of A of G is an element of the Lie algebra, and the variation is an element of the Lie algebra. So what I'm calling F prime, if I'm careful, is the following thing. So what is F prime of A of G means the following thing. If I go back to elements. Okay. For each X and A, I have an FA of X of A G of X. See, for each point and each coordinate, I have something that, and I have the gauge condition that this may be equal to zero for all X and A. So X belong to space, time, and A is 1, 2, 3, so these are group indices. Okay? So now I write that G, so G is a gauge function. So G So F is a collection of sets like that. So similarly, G is a collection of element G of X, which belongs to the group. Okay. So making a transformation means that I change G into G times 1 plus I alpha of X, and alpha of X belongs to the Lie algebra, so it can be written as alpha A of X TA. So this is G, which is a 2x2 matrix times the identity matrix plus I alpha A of X T A, where this is a generator. T A is one half of the Pauli matrix. Okay, and that's the identity matrix. So, taking the derivative means that you consider those objects and you consider their derivative with respect to the alpha A of X. You see. So, this means making functional derivative of this, FA AG of X, with respect to variation of the alpha B of Y for all A, B, X, and Y. Because in general, the gauge fixing transformation involves derivatives, so it's non-local. In general, F is non-local. It involves derivative of A. Okay, so in fact, what the elements of F prime of AG, its element, are kernels. Let me call it G of X and Y. That's what I'm going in my notes of AB. So this is a kernel of an operator acting on function on the D algebra. And they are defined by, more precisely, by the functional derivative of the function FA of A, where G is taken to be G times 1 plus I alpha, taken at point X when I make a variation of alpha, the component B of alpha, at point Y. See, so if we are careful about the component, about the indices, F prime is in fact the kernel of an operator. It's a kernel of an operator, an integral operator, acting on functions from space to the Lie algebra of the group. So it depends both on two space indices, the positions, and the indices in the Lie. Yes?
So is G, are we considering G a function of alpha of X?
G here is, of course, no. Well, G is a gauge transformation. G is a G of X. So I change G of X into G of X times 1 plus I alpha of X. But so G is here, G is fixed, and it's G 1 plus I alpha, which is a function of alpha.
So G of X is a gauge transformation, but
yeah, G of X is an element. So here I integrate over G. I have a delta function of A gauge transformed by G. And here I considered the determinant of an operator which depends on G. And this operator is defined by this condition. So this object depends on G. This depends on A and G, because it depends on A of G.
Why, if G of X is in the group, when you're considering small transformations of it, why don't you multiply by like the inverse on the other side, or like.
I did this by writing the differentiation with respect to alpha. You see. Writing a variation with respect to alpha of x is the same thing as writing a variation of g minus 1 of x, well, of delta g of x, something like that. It's the same thing. It's a logarithmic derivative, if you want, in tangent space. I prefer to write this in my note because otherwise it's confusing if you start to do calculation. Okay?
So should there not be, if the prime means like you're taking a variation with respect to g.
I take a variation with respect to g.
Like variations with respect to alpha, so should there be like a factor of 1 over g or something?
It's taken into account by this definition.
You take the derivative, you get the logarithmic derivative. So here he takes the derivative with respect to e to the I alpha.
It's the same thing that taking the derivative with respect to g as the given value of g. So my it's the same thing. Simply I write this in my notes because otherwise it gets a bit confusing. But basically, this is a function of g. You make a small variation with respect to g by changing g into g prime, which is given by this infinitesimal variation. You take the derivative, and then you compute this derivative at g. So you still have a function of g. Okay. So it's a bit abstract, but you are going to see that using this becomes very convenient on an explicit example of the gauge. Of the gauge fixing, which is the Lorentz gauge. Okay. But that's the formal definition. So f prime of a of g is an operator acting as function, therefore it has a functional determinant, and that's what we are going to use. So this is an operator, and this is a functional determinant. Of the same, very same kind than the functional determinant we have been considering in perturbation theory for phi to the 4 when computing the effective action. Okay. So it's a bit of a heavy notation, but once you have understood that, the notation are very compact. Okay. So. I want to insert 1 in this z. So what I'm doing is that this big functional integral, I write it as an integral over gauge configuration, so over my big gauge field. Then I introduce an integral over a gauge transformation. And then I insert a delta function for the gauge constraint to pick up the g such that a of g is on the gauge slice. So I write delta of f of a g. And then I have to introduce this absolute value of a determinant of this functional, this operator, which depends on AOG. So this F prime, which depends on where I am, so of A of G. So that's a functional determinant. Okay. And then I have exponential of minus the action of A. Okay. So in fact, I've done nothing. Well, in my note, I am using, I'm in Minkowski space, here I am in Euclidean space, but that's important because we are dealing just with what's going on in terms of the measure. So it's the same for Minkowski or Euclidean space, because the measure doesn't change. Okay, and now comes the trick. Let's invert the two integrals and write this as integral over G, d of G, integral over A, d of A, delta of F of A, determinant, absolute determinant of the functional, absolute value of the functional determinant of the operator F prime of A of G, time exponential of minus the action of A. So I've inverted the two integrals. Yes?
Should be F of A of G, the second order?
Yes, thank you. Of course, that's crucial. Yeah, thank you. Yes?
When is it mathematically allowed to interchange two functional integrals?
In this case, it's better justified that in other cases, because we are integrating over some elements of a group, an infinite dimensional group. Otherwise, but you are right. Are we allowed to integrate? In fact, yes, because you can discretize everything. In fact, Ken Wilson, that's one of his other achievements, showed how to define gauge theories on a lattice with an explicit gauge invariant. And on a lattice, you have a finite number of degrees of freedom. So all those integrals become finite dimensional integral, and the exchange of integrals is justified. So yes. Okay, so here I've just exchanged the integral. But here, now I use gauge invariance. Up to now, I've not used gauge invariance at all. Now, use gauge invariance. I've just played with the measure. I use gauge invariance, which means that I can make a gauge transformation here and here. You see. And this means that I can replace A F of A, I can replace it by D of AG, exponential of minus S of AG. Because G is fixed. So for each G, I can make a change of variable, which depends on G. Okay? And this is equal. So you see, this depends on A of G already, and I can replace A by A of G here. And then I can just change of notation, because then A of G is a dummy variable. Because if G is fixed, there is AG here, AG here, AG here, and AG here. So I can rewrite this of A, like A. So I can rewrite this as integral over G, D of G, times integral over A, the measure over the A, the new A, the delta of F of A, the absolute value of the determinant of F prime of A, it depends on A, times the exponential of the action of A. And you see, now this integral and this integral are completely independent. G doesn't appear here because of gauge invariance. And this factors out. And this is just the volume of the big G group. It's the integral with the R measure over the group. So it's a constant factor. Yes?
I don't understand why the change of variables, of labels of this variable.
Pardon?
Why does the change of variables not affect the f of a, that of f prime of a?
Because this is a function. This is a function of. This is a function of the gauge field variable, a gauge field configuration a g. So this is a gauge field configuration. I don't see why you are worried. It depends on G, you mean?
A.
Yeah, it depends on A and on G.
Yeah.
But if I consider just this integral, before performing the integration over G, I consider this with G fixed.
Yes.
And then. Yeah.
Action, but why not in the delta, the determinant? Why does it remain the same?
Because I know that this measure times this is, it doesn't depend. If I perform a change of variable here, so you see, this is a measure somewhere in
right.
This space. And I know that the measure, as a measure, at this point, is equal to the measure at this point. So I can replace. That's because the measure and the action, so you can view this as a big measure, this measure is invariant. It's just that. But gauge invariant comes here, okay? Okay. Okay, so I have this volume, and this comes out, and therefore, this is the gauge fixed action. This is a gauge fixed functional integral. Okay. And this determinant is called the Fadeyev Popov determinant. It's a Jacobian associated to the choice of gauge measure. And now, if everything works and we have gauge invariance, this should be independent of the choice of the function f. Okay, so now I have 25 minutes. So and now comes the second beauty. So this is the first trick. The first trick is to write the to take into account the gauge fixing condition
in the functional integral by introducing this determinant. And if you don't take into account this determinant, you have something which is not gauge invariant, which depends on f. Because of course the determinant depends on choice of function f. Okay. Okay. So now the second trick. This is the Fadeyev Popov. I'm sorry, there is an F now. Ghosts trick. We have a functional determinant. We have we have the absolute value of a determinant. Okay. Now, assume that the sign of the determinant doesn't change. But it turns out that this is true if you have no problem with a group of copies. Okay. So assume that you can replace the determinant of f prime by the absolute value of the determinant of f prime by the determinant of f prime. And that's okay if no copies problem. So it's the same reason that here you can have two zeros if the function change sign. But if it change sign, it means at some point its slope is zero, so its determinant, its derivative vanishes. Okay. So if no copies, you have a determinant, a functional determinant. And remember fermions, determinant of operators can be written as dc bar dc of exponential minus c bar the operator c, where c and c bar are Grassmann variables, anti-commuting fields. And here it's a functional determinant. So the C's and C bars are going to be functions from space-time onto the Lie algebra of the group. Because remember here G carries a space index and Lorentz index. Okay. So they are going to be functions CA of X and C bar equal C bar of X, C bar A of X, with A goes from 1 to 3. But you see, they do not carry Lorentz indices or Dirac indices. So they are spin zero field. And so they carry problem with unitarity. Those are the famous ghosts. Okay. So this is very this is quite abstract, but now of course what we have to do is to do some explicit calculation. The formalism I have used here is very general, so it applies to any gauge group. But of course, we have to think of what's going on where when we use the Lorentz gauge. Now, in fact, it's going to be also working for the Feynman gauge. Because in this case, what's written? The function A is FA of X is D mu A mu A of X. And let's write plus epsilon if we like. So epsilon is a constant, it's a constant function, so it's not going to change anything. Okay. Now, so this is a function, okay. So this is a function, if this is a functional of the gauge field configuration A of X. So it's a function. So it's a function of A, but in a very simple way, because it depends on A only by its derivative at the point X. But still, it doesn't depend locally on A, because it doesn't depend on A at the point X, but it depends on A through of A. At point X. Okay, so now if we perform a gauge transformation, I want to change A into AG with G equal the identity plus I alpha of X. So I know what is the scale deformation. I know that A mu A of X is transformed into A mu A of X plus the covariant derivative d mu of alpha of X, A of X, which is A mu A of X plus D mu of alpha A of X plus the commutator, which is in our case epsilon A B C A mu B of X alpha C of X. That's the commutator because we are in SU2. And so, what is the variation of F of A? Of F of A. What is the variation of D mu A when I change A into this A prime? Well, it's easy. The variation, so the variation of, if you want the variation delta of F of A of X is d mu of the variation. So it's a, okay. So it's d mu, the original, the ordinary derivative of the covariant derivative, which depend on A, of alpha A of X. So this is d mu of alpha A of X. It's just the derivative of this. And then there is the derivative of this. So I get plus epsilon A, B, C, the ordinary derivative of the products of A mu B of X and alpha C of X. Okay. So this is the ordinary derivative, and that's the derivative that acts both on alpha and on A. That's for SU2. For U1, there is no commutator. So it's only this. For an abelian gauge series. So in fact, there is a Fadeyev Popov determinant even for the Maxwell theory, but it doesn't depend on the gauge field, so you can factor it out too. That's why quantization of Maxwell theory is much simpler. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
When you take that variation.
Well.
When you take that variation,
yes.
There's no dependence on f on the form of f on the right hand side.
Right. Well, the form of f is this. This is f.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
well then.
It's for this f.
And it's varying.
So I vary. I start from f of a and I make a gauge transformation on a.
Right, okay.
And see how, I just see how f of a changes. Okay? You see. So you see that this variation is transforms. So this is this operator. You see, you can write this as f prime of a of alpha, and you take the component a at position x. You see. So this gives you the kernel operator f prime. So the kernel operator. Of f prime of a. So it's just here. Here you have a standard Laplacian and you do not change the index. So the kernel operator of f prime, this g, if you prefer, this g is just, well, the ordinary Laplacian operator times delta AB plus epsilon ABC, the term that comes from the fact that the commutator, and then you can write d mu as either d mu acts on A mu, so you get A mu B. There is just it's a mu. There is a c, so that's what we, delta AC. There is a mistake in my notes. It's delta ABC A mu B. A mu B of x times the operator d mu acting on alpha c, acting to the right. Plus epsilon ABC d mu A mu B of x function. You see, or if you prefer, you can integrate by part and say that you have d mu acting on the left. So this is delta x, delta ABC, delta AC. Minus epsilon ABC d mu acting on the right times A mu B of x. And that's it. So this is a matrix element. This is f prime of A, AC.
Shouldn't this be?
A delta of x minus y? Yeah, but it's the delta x minus y is taken into account in the fact that we write it as a differential operator, you see. You can write the operator delta of x as the operator whose kernel is this delta of a delta function of x minus y. It's up to you. The operator is local, but not ultra-local, because it involves the derivative of the function you applied. It's exactly that what we did in our calculation of the effective potential.
Yes, because if you had it somehow in F, I don't know if you can, such that this variation was not proportional to the delta, would you have a better veno-local close? Could you have that?
No, you mean if the F function would have been non-local in the sense that I've been involving not only derivatives, but I'm pretty sure. If you had a function which was non-local, a gauge fixing function which had non-local, then you had non-local growth. Yes, but that's I'm not aware of people using that. It's becoming too complicated. Yeah. Yes, but that's true. You can enforce a gauge fixing condition which is non-local, but it's not very natural because since the gauge transformation are local. If you start to use gauge fixing, which are non-local, you are making things very complicated. But they can involve higher derivatives, and then, or they can be non-linear in the fields, and they can be more complicated. Yes?
Where does the function epsilon come in?
Pardon?
Where does the function epsilon figure in?
Where do you see a... I'm sorry, I don't understand your
So F equals derivative of A minus epsilon.
Ah, I'm sorry, this epsilon is this gauge, this Feynman additional parameter. But so it's not epsilon ABC, it's just another function. It's called epsilon, but you can call it. Or if you prefer, it's not important here, so you can forget about it. Since it's a constant, as soon as you take a derivative of this. If you take a variation with respect to A of this, the variation of epsilon is zero. So you can forget about it. It's not important for the gauge fixing.
What does it do though in general?
What if?
What does it do in general? What is the purpose in general for
this? The purpose is to simplify perturbative calculation. I'm going to explain that on Friday. Pardon?
Determines which A's you're actually integrating over when you evaluate the delta part of the integral.
What do you want to integrate over? The
part of the A's, like the integral over dA of delta F of A is equivalent to the integral over A's such that gauge condition is true.
No, it's equivalent to
plays a role.
No, it's a delta function of f of a. So if you want to play the game again and rewrite this as a delta of a, you have to introduce an additional Jacobian. So that's the simplest way to get in fact. For simple gauge, like for instance the axial gauge, where a naught equals zero. Which means the Coulomb potential is zero, then of course you can just integrate over A. But then there is no Fadeyev Popov determinant. You can compute. You can compute the axial gauge, which is convenient for calculation on the lattice. You have the gauge potential, which is A zero, and the space vector potential. And if you set A 0 equals 0, you can integrate over D of the A. So you have realized in the functional integral from scratch the gauge fixing condition. You are right. And in that case, in this case, this gauge fixing condition implies that the Fadeyev Popov determinant is constant. So you can factor it out. But the gauge, the axial gauge, is very tricky for perturbative calculation because it introduces additional infrared singularities, and a lot of problems. So it's used for some problem. For some problem, it's useful, but it's tricky.
What I mean is that the functional integral over dA times the delta FA,
yes,
times all the rest,
yes,
is equivalent to the functional integral over dA's such that F of over A such that F of A equals zero.
In general, not. Because you have to specify which measure you put on the space of A such that F of A equals zero. And that's a measure. That's a solution to the problem you raise. This is a measure you must put on the slice. You see, this measure is localized on the slice. But in general, it's non-trivial. It depends on where you are on the slice. And the Fadiyev-Popov gauge fixing procedure tells you which the slice is, which is a measure. And this measure, in general, is not a flat measure because the slice is a curved space in the space of gauge potential. And there are some very special cases where the slice is flat, and I think the only one I know is the XL gauge. Okay? Well, let me finish because... Then I want to just to write you what is the final result. The final result is that since the Fadiyev-Popov determinant is a differential operator which depends on the gauge field, so the final action is the final functional integral. You have an integral over A, the original A. You have an integral over the Gauss field. Okay? When you have a delta function of a gauge fixing, you can realize it by introducing a Lagrange multiplier. Let me call it D lambda. Because I can write that this delta of f of a, which means in fact product over x, product of a of a f a of a at point x, it's a product of delta function. So this can be written as a product over x, a product over a, an integral over some d lambda a of x from minus infinity to plus infinity of exponential of I lambda a of x f a of x, and can and this product becomes basically an integral over d lambda of exponential of I integral over dx lambda a of x fa a of x. The product of an exponential is the exponential of the product. So you can introduce an what's called an auxiliary field, which enforce the constraint, and this lambda belongs to the Lie algebra of the gauge group because it carries just space indices. Okay? So you can define this, and then you have as an action, first you have your 1 over 2g squared integral d4x of trace of f. I think this is the Young-Mills actions. Then you have a Fadiyev-Popov determinant here, which is explicitly exponential of minus integral d dx c bar of x times lambda of x plus well, A of x delta AC minus, well, plus epsilon ABC. Well, if you prefer, nabla of x of C, C A of x, okay, plus C A bar of x epsilon A B C D mu of A mu B of x times C C of x. This is a Gauss plus gauge action. And then you have this gauge field with exponential I integral dx lambda f a of a of x, which enforce the gauge fixing. Okay. And with that, you see that. And of course, it depends on A. And you see that if you combine this with this, I'm going to describe that a bit more later, you get a propagator with a gauge field. Which is, so the gauge field carry spin indices and group indices, okay? And you get, for instance, the standard propagator for the Maxwell theory. With longitudinal modes projected out. Because this, at first order, just removes the longitudinal modes. So you get the same propagator than the one for the Maxwell theory in the Lorentz gauge. You have the interaction vertices that come from the Young-Mead theory from the term from the propagator. And then you have a Gauss propagator. But the Gauss propagator has just a lambda square, so it's so the Gauss propagator contains an A and C index, and it's just delta AC divided by P squared, well, plus I epsilon. So it's a propagator of a boson, of a charged boson. But in addition, these terms describe the coupling between the gauge field and the Gauss. And this coupling is similar to the coupling in quantum electrodynamics. You have Gauss, and then you have a gauge field. You see? And the Gauss field carries indices. The gauge field carries spin, space-time indices, and therefore the couplings involves here the incoming momenta E mu of the Gauss here, and the structure constant epsilon A, B, C of the gauge field. So the Gauss are charged. They carry charges. And they exchange charges with the Gauss. And they interact with the gauge bosons. And so this Fadeev Popov, the Fadeev Popov determinant is realized by this term. And it introduced new diagram in perturbation theory that I'm going to discuss on Friday, which changes the perturbation theory if you compare it to what you have done, you would have get if you would have just naively fixed the gauge and computed without taking into account precisely the effect of gauge invariance of the measure. So I'm going to describe that tomorrow. But those are the terms I discussed very briefly, the interaction vertices, which are present in the Young-Mills action. And these are the new terms that come when you quantize properly the theory. They can be formulated in terms of those ghost fields. Of course, those ghost fields are just a mathematical way to represent the gauge fixing term. But they are a convenient way because they represent it in terms of local fields. So a large part of ordinary perturbation of ordinary quantum field theory formalism will still be there to, and we can rely on it instead of looking at some complicated non-local quantum field theory. Okay, thank you.